Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. Welcome to the Picking Up the Pieces podcast. We're going to kind of look back and reflect on some of the moves that were made after the All-Star break and the trade deadline and the buyout season. But before we get into, you know, the blockbuster Deron Williams signing and some of these other turns of course, we need to pick up the pieces of your life. Because the internet told me that you got really old over the past week, didn't you?
Wow, I did not expect to. You said you had a twist up your sleeve. I did not expect to discuss my 30th birthday, but yes, I turned 30 recently, and it's good. I went on vacation with my wife this weekend to Miami to celebrate, and let me tell you something. After spending 3 days in February in Miami, I understand LeBron's decision on a whole new level. Like, it's surprising that more people don't just ditch their team to go down there.
So did you stay at like a hotel or did you just go straight to the Senior Citizen Center?
No, I stayed at a hotel. And it's funny though, because you do, walking around South Beach, you do feel like really uncool. And I feel like if I were LeBron, and if I were an NBA superstar, there's nowhere better in America, really. But for me, just sort of like awkward journalist, it's pretty funny to be in the middle of like Ukrainian millionaires and a bunch of like fashion people. But we had fun, you know? It was good.
Yeah, don't you get the vibe there's always going to be like some big cocaine takedown, like just some narco squad is just going to like, you know, pull down a pickup truck with like $4 million worth of coke in the back as you're walking around Miami. That's the feeling I always kind of had.
Yeah, there's always some sketchy people in the midst. And like, I went for a run on Saturday afternoon and I was just running sort of down South Beach. They have a little path. And like every block, there was a new sort of like bumping party in the backyard in like the pool area of every hotel. It was like a club scene at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, every block of South Beach. So it was quite a scene, but I had fun. And, I'm now old. I'm now like sort of Deron Williams age, buyout age. I can accept it.
Yeah. So you went straight from a party with old guys like Michael Jordan, straight to the old folks capital of the world, South Florida.
That's right.
Boy. Good thing you're still podcasting with me to keep you young.
Yeah. And I'm glad this. So it feels like we're kind of in like a dead zone of the NBA season. I think like the whole league kind of lost its mind last week with the Boogie trade and the trade deadline. And now everyone's sort of catching our breath here. So it's good that we started off with like a couple minutes on my birthday. And we are just going to sort of bounce around today because we don't really have a plan here.
It is kind of a post-apocalyptic NBA. You know, the number 30 team in net rating right now is the New Orleans Pelicans, so after the deadline. So they've had the toughest time. I was getting messages from Kings fans telling me I was going to owe Vlade an apology once the Kings made the playoffs. Okay, that one probably not quite going to happen. But there's been all sorts of weirdness, right? And maybe we should start in New Orleans. Like, it hasn't worked at all. DeMarcus Cousins, Anthony Davis, they've gotten some numbers. DeMarcus had a technical foul early in one of his games already with them. It really hasn't been that transformative look and feel. And their depth issues, I think, to me, are still pretty glaring. And I guess that's kind of what happens when you trade multiple pieces for one guy. And then, you know, Caspi, who, you know, we kind of penciled in as a pretty nice steal from that deal, he just goes down. But I don't think it's too early to say the Pelicans are kind of on life support here when it comes to the playoffs.
Yeah, you know, and I feel bad about this because even when we did the Boogie podcast last week, I kind of threw in there in fine print, like, I don't think this is going to work in New Orleans, at least this year. But I, at the same time, then we also got like really excited about what's possible with Boogie and Brow there. And it is really cool to think about. But when you also consider how little time they have to make this fit and how crappy like the rest of the roster is, like, losing Omri Caspi should not have been a big deal, but it kind of was because they just don't have many other like NBA caliber options there. I mean, like Solomon Hill is not gonna is not like a cog on a legit playoff team. So I don't know, man. I don't want to overreact. I don't want to be the guy who like overhypes the Pelicans and then immediately like kicks dirt on their grave. But I do feel like they're probably not going to make the playoffs. And then you come into this summer and it's like, all right, so they've got one more year with Boogie. Like, let's see what's possible. Cause it's not going to be easy to build around that team and to make it work under pressure. So like, I just think we all have to sort of take a wait and see approach with the Boogie era in New Orleans.
Yeah. A few things had me concerned down there. First, you know, outside factors in terms of teams like Portland, Dallas, you know, Denver. I mean, there's always a stability level to all three of those teams right now. I mean, they've, you know, added in new pieces in some cases like Dallas with Noel, but they've kind of been rolling along at a certain pace all season. They don't have to change anything, you know, here for the home stretch. And so that makes it even harder for New Orleans to swim upstream.
Yeah.
I think my big concern, though, with the Pelicans, you know, if you're Drew Holiday, do you just kind of say goodbye to this mess this summer and just kind of bounce? I mean,
well,
he's going to have a lot of options. I mean, he's going to be one of these guys who's weighing just crazy big contracts because a lot of the point guards, the A-listers, you know, Chris Paul, Lowry, Curry. I mean, I don't really see any of those guys going anywhere. So if you're a team that needs a point guard, he's going to be at the top of your list. If you're him, do you want to be the guy tasked with trying to make this weird configuration work with a coaching style and system that's not really designed to, you know, focus on big men?
Do
you want to just try something else?
It cuts both ways, though, because if you're the Pelicans, do you really want to pay Drew Holiday $25 million a year? I mean, because I think you're right that there's going to be a market there, but are we sure, like, is Drew Holiday, how good is Drew Holiday?
I think he's really good. I mean, the problem is he can't stay on the court.
Yeah.
And that's
my thing. Like, if he's healthy version of Drew Holiday for the past 6 weeks has been actually really good and definitely worth investing in if you're New Orleans. But, like, they're going to have to take a long look at him this summer and say, like, do we trust this guy to stay on the court? Because otherwise, like, that's, they need those resources to build out the rest of the roster, because the rest of the team is just like, it's rough, man. Let me see. I'll pull up the roster here to.
Well, I was going to say, like, they're over a barrel, though, because if it's not Drew Holiday, then it's like Jarrett Jack. You know, I mean, that's kind of what they've been scraping along here lately after the deadline. I mean, there are other pieces, you know, Tim Frazier's of the world. I mean, they're guys who are, you know, D-League players or people who have been really on the fringes of the league, bouncing in and out. The gap between Drew Holiday and those guys is significant.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe playing in New Orleans' favor is a loyalty factor. I mean, they definitely gave him a wide berth when he was going through his family issues. I mean, that always helps. And I'm sure he feels a responsibility on that side of things too. But I think that, you know, once the dazzling move of the DeMarcus Cousins trade kind of played out, what's left in New Orleans is like a really sticky situation, because I think they're going to have to pay full. I don't think they're going to get a discount on Holiday.
Yeah.
And then if he does leave, then what do you do? I mean, are you turning this over to a rookie? I mean, who are you going to even be able to pick up? Derrick Rose? I mean, really go for the Calipari route? I don't know.
Well, speaking of Calipari, do you think that Alvin Gentry is the right guy to coach this team? And again, I feel really bad sort of like going from Pelicans excitement to immediate concern trolling. That's a legit question, right?
I think it has to be. I mean, stylistically, you know, I'm not sure how much has he really helped unlock Anthony Davis since he's been there. And then his entire approach in terms of, you know, pace, Warriors style, you know, spread and three-point shooting is not really what you're going to have to do if you're building your team around your four and your five. So I don't know who the right coach is to coach these guys in this era. I mean, it's just a totally different look. And if you're New Orleans, you also face, you know, some pretty grim realities. Like, who are you going to be able to get? Number one, you've got to sell that new coach on Cousins. You got to make sure he's on board personality-wise. And then number two, you've got to just, you know, kind of tell this coach, hey, everybody else is playing perimeter-oriented basketball. We're going to try to make it work with a four and a five, two bigs down low. You're going to be cutting completely against the grain of the way basketball is being played right now. I mean, that's a tough sell too. Plus, you're in New Orleans with no real track record of winning and any of the other things that people look for when they're coaching candidates. You know, I was actually reading Brian Windhorst and Dave McMenamin. They have a new book coming out called Return of the King.
Oh, did you get an early copy?
I did, yeah. Sorry, not trying to brag about it. I just was reading it yesterday.
No, I almost hit up Dave to ask him for an early copy, so maybe I should do that.
Well, early in the book, I think one of the most interesting parts is they're going through Cleveland's struggles to hire a coach when they ultimately decided to get Blatt. And then they remember that weird situation where they brought in Ty Lue as like a super highly paid associate head coach.
Yeah.
They basically shook every tree, you know, trying to find a coach. Izzo, they went in and looked at like Kansas's coach. They really went through an extensive coaching search trying to find the right guy. And they made it pretty clear, because they didn't have LeBron at that point, how difficult it was to really sell that organization to high-profile candidates.
Yeah.
And I think that's where New Orleans would find themselves too, right? Like, is that a real dream job? I mean, you know, if you're a coaching free agent, you know, whoever that number one name might be, let's just, you know, Jeff Van Gundy or whoever, you know, people would say, who's going to be jumping at that opportunity? Doesn't it kind of seem like you're being set up to fail a little bit?
And you know what's interesting is that a couple years ago, it very much was a dream job. Like when Gentry took it, there were rumors that Tibbs was interested. I mean, like the chance to coach the next 10 years of Anthony Davis was as attractive as any job in the NBA. And it just, there's been so much dysfunction since that, yeah, you're right. It is, some of the luster has left that spot. And it's tough. You bring up the Izzo thing. That's actually a fantastic, like what if, I mean, cause I don't think he committed to Cleveland based on Blatt at all. Like at the time, it seemed like the Blatt hire was really smart. And I actually remember writing that, like, maybe he has renewed faith in the front office because of Blatt. Obviously, we saw down the line that, like, Blatt was the one thing in Cleveland that, like, LeBron never really connected with. And it would have been amazing to watch him try to adjust to Tom Izzo, because Tom Izzo is not really, like, the type of dude to just roll over. And that could have been, like, a fun social experiment.
Yeah, there's lots of good Blatt versus LeBron drama in this book. I mean, it started from day one. It started from like day one at training camp, where they're about to have their practice or whatever. LeBron calls a players only meeting and tells all the players like what their job's going to be. And Blatt has no idea this is taking place.
Look, I still think Blatt could be a good NBA head coach somewhere. So maybe the Pelicans should hire David Blatt.
That's a hot take. That's a hot take.
No, he came into a real nightmare situation, and I think he's worth a shot. Maybe this podcast is the trade deadline, like, reality check, and we could just sort of go through reality checks around the league, because
here's a quick reality check. David Blatt might have gone into a nightmare situation, but he went in with a nightmare personality, and it's never going to work. He has to get over himself if he's ever going to be a successful NBA coach, and he's got a long way to do that. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
All right, fine. Fair enough. I'm not going to like cape up for David Blatt here, because I don't know enough about the situation, and I feel like you've just spent the last week reading off the record like anecdotes about his time in Cleveland. So you're probably right, but
no, I told you this is very personal to me, though. Remember, my favorite press conference moment in NBA history was when LeBron threw Blatt under the bus during those playoffs. So I'm going to be like, you know, anti-Blatt for the rest of my life.
Okay, fair enough. Let's keep the reality checks going, though.
Shouldn't we talk about Toronto, though? I mean, we kind of just buried the Pelicans, and Toronto is kind of like this Lowry thing. They're kind of standing by their grave, ready to be buried. I mean, worst possible timing for a major injury. Can they survive this, do you think? I mean, is this the kind of thing where it's like almost like a Clippers situation where, you know, Chris Paul goes down and it's just like season over? Or are they going to be able to kind of squeeze in just enough recovery time to kind of pull themselves together before the playoffs?
So, am I crazy in feeling like this, there's a chance that this could be a blessing in disguise? Because I mean, Lowry had a lot of mileage on him coming into the All-Star break. And if he can get healthy by the playoffs, like, I didn't think the Raptors were going to catch the Celtics in that two spot. And if Lowry can get right by the time the playoffs start, then this amounts to like 6 weeks that he's not playing 38 to 40 minutes a game, which is probably a good thing, right?
I hear what you're saying. I guess what I'm concerned about is, like, does Rusty Kyle come back and just, you know, sideshow the offense? Because he's got the ball so much. He takes so many shots. He actually takes, you know, a fair number of tough shots. You know, is he in prime, you know, physical condition after being away for, you know, a month or 5-6 weeks, whatever it'll be? And then he doesn't have the development time with his new teammates. And I actually think, you know, that's probably not the biggest concern. I mean, PJ Tucker is just a plug and play, you know, warrior on defense. I think he's going to have his Raptors jersey retired probably next week because the fans up there are just in love with him. And I think Ibaka is so versatile, you can pretty much use him however you want. But they are changing things. You know, Jonas is playing a little bit fewer minutes. They are going through this kind of like gelling process, and Lowry's not there for any of it. You know, credit to DeMar DeRozan. I mean, he's kind of carrying their offense at this point and milking it along on life support.
Okay, hold up. But, can we just talk about how badly you would have killed DeRozan if he had missed that contested game winner in New York last night?
Well, that's a shot you're happy with, you know, 9 out of 10 times. That's a shot that goes in against the Knicks in February and not against the Cavs in May.
Yeah, but, okay, fair enough.
You know, I think that these are real questions for Toronto. And like matchup wise, if you start on the road, and we kind of all agree that the second tier of the East, you know, whether it's, you know, Washington, Boston, I'm gonna throw Atlanta in there, it's all pretty closely packed. I mean, the difference between having home court, not having home court, you know, gelling at the right time, pulling everything together and not, is probably the difference between, you know, winning a series or not winning a series. I mean, isn't that kind of the margin that we're talking about? Or are you still thinking that they're a cut above teams like Washington and Atlanta based on what they did last year?
I mean, I think that they have enough talent to be in the mix with anyone that they're going to play in April and May. And I think you're right. Like, the questions that you raise are all real, and it's really dangerous to say any injury is a good thing. I just think that, like, there's less reason to panic over this, that there's at least a chance that this could still work out just fine for the Raptors, and that they'll be similarly situated to what we expected when we get to the playoffs. Because the other thing with Lowry is, like, he's had nagging injuries the last 2 years, and he hasn't missed extended time. And then those injuries have affected the way he played in the playoffs. So, like, maybe this is a great point. Different approach that could work out. I mean,
yeah. I guess what I'm worried about is you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't, right? Like, maybe that's the situation.
Well, you're not really damned until you have to then commit $150 million to, like, kind of injury prone Kyle Lowry this summer.
No, that's a good point. Maybe it is just Chris Paul, you know, visions of Chris Paul's injury issues coming back to bite them in the playoffs, you know, whether he comes back in time or not, that's kind of got me. I mean, Blake had that same situation last year where he comes back just enough in time, but, you know, he can't pull together to hold up for a first round series. I mean, maybe that's what's got me a little bit scared here for them.
Yeah.
You know, I think this also does kind of go back, though, to Dwayne Casey's minutes management, right? Because he put a lot on Lowry. He puts a ton on DeRozan in terms of minutes and touches and usage. You know, they're up there on the list for all those things. And, you know, if this winds up being something that derails their season, I think that's going to come back on him, don't you?
Yeah, well, and coaching was always sort of the question mark, even as the Raptors kind of won the deadline. It was like, all right, well, let's see if Dwayne Casey can manage these pieces. I'm, again, not that concerned with the Raptors. Although, if you look across the whole East, like, coming into the All-Star break, I wrote about how, you know, this is the first year that the East playoffs could actually be fun. And there are, like, three or four challengers to LeBron. And it's nice to have a little bit of, like, legitimate drama there. And now it's, again, like, kind of the reality check after the hype. Like, the Wizards have come out of the break looking flat as hell, and just kind of, you know, you need more than 6 or 7 good players to compete for 6 months straight. And, like, so, and then the Celtics looked awful against the Hawks on Monday night, and people, there's, like, now a whole Celtics backlash against the Al Horford deal, and then there's another faction of Celtics fans that are pissed off that they didn't add anybody at the deadline. No, maybe not a star, but like they didn't add anybody. So like
that's what I was saying.
Everybody's kind of in crisis in the East. And I would only say that I think what we saw over December and January was the real version of these teams. Like they're all pretty good, and they will all be factors in the playoffs. And over the next couple weeks, I think there's going to be people reading too much into what we see down the stretch here.
I'm with you, sort of. What my concern is that what we saw before the All-Star break was like the best case scenario versions of those teams. And that once we get to the postseason matchup, they're playing each other. Everybody's focused in on how to take away what those teams do well on offense. It could devolve into pretty ugly stuff.
Yeah.
Because none of those teams are like super loaded with complementary scoring options. And so I am a little nervous that we're going to enter the playoffs with like really high hopes for those first and second round series. And then some of these teams are going to wind up playing a little bit uglier than we expected. And some of the magic that we saw from guys like Isaiah Thomas might not be there at the same level. And, you know, we'll see. But it has been pretty sobering for those second tier teams. I mean, nobody is really jetting out of the break, you know, like on a real high plane.
Yeah. Well, let me just say that like the Wizards, they lost the Jazz on Sunday. They lost the Sixers on Friday night. They host the Warriors later today, Tuesday night. It's going to be kind of a rough stretch here for them. And then they have a back-to-back. They go to Toronto on Wednesday night and then host the Raptors on Friday. So, like, I don't know. I think the way you explained it is perfect. What we saw coming into the break was best-case scenario for Boston and Washington, and then trade deadline version of the Raptors, as we all imagine this, like, five-man unit was the best-case scenario for the Raptors. And now I think we might see some of the worst-case scenario with these teams. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. So I just don't want to end up reading a bunch of think pieces about like where the Celtics went wrong based on like 10 days of subpar play, and ditto for the Wizards. It's like, this is not a huge deal.
I feel you. Hey, I've got another reality check for you though.
Okay.
Did you happen to see the Cavaliers play without LeBron James against the Bulls and compare that to the Warriors when they played without Kevin Durant?
I don't think you can compare the Warriors to anyone because they're so stacked that it's just not the same deal. But yeah, watching the Cavs without LeBron is wild, man. Because like,
it's that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a real strike against Kyrie that for 3 years straight they just look awful whenever LeBron decides to take the night off.
Yeah, I mean, they don't look like a team. They don't function cohesively when LeBron's out there. I mean, it shows you how much he's doing it from the orchestration standpoint. And also, like, don't Kyrie's points all just look entirely empty? It's like, yes. Oh, cool layup, like really sweet layup. like that's, you know, like really high degree of difficulty. That's awesome. Like you're still losing by 15 or 20 points. And like Dwayne Wade's out there like stunting all over you. Dwayne Wade.
Yeah. We may not talk enough about how LeBron was like the best thing that ever happened to Kyrie Irving's career, because he was kind of like I had a scout compare him to like Steve Francis coming into the year. And then basically if you put Steve Francis on LeBron's team, like prime two, I guess this was like maybe 2005 Steve Francis, like that's an awesome player to pair with someone like LeBron, but like he's not really a point guard. And basically LeBron does everything that Kyrie doesn't do well, and Kyrie gets to just like do his own thing, and it's perfect. But left to his own devices, I'm not even sure if he's like a top five point guard.
Yeah, I don't think he is. I mean, and you almost don't even call him a point guard.
Yeah.
I think you could, if you want to call him a two, then you know he might be in the top five discussion for sure as like a pure scorer. But yeah, it was an ugly game. Like, against the Bulls,
he's elite in a very specific role that really only exists for him, and like, and he's great, and we don't need to like relitigate all the different Kyrie arguments because he's great at exactly what he does. But it just, his career would have never come anywhere near to this level without Bron showing up there like 4 years in.
Yeah, for sure. And then compare that to Golden State. You know, KD goes out. They didn't even look like they missed him, you know. And I'm one of these people who's putting Durant into the MVP conversation. But the way that they adapted, filled his minutes, filled his shots, spread everything else out, you know, just roll off these double-digit victories. It's like, you know, it kind of made me think, like, reality check-wise, like, hey, there's lots of cute moves out there. Houston, like, you know, high five for the Lou Williams play. You know, you can go right down the list of some of these other ones. But the talent gap still between Golden State and everybody else is just massive. And I actually would throw Cleveland into that mix. I mean, we're talking about the number of minutes that Golden State's main guys have played together, the fact that they haven't had to take on these huge burdens, their overall excellent health, and then just the steadiness of their program, you know, in terms of the decision makers, coaching staff, and so forth. Like, they're just cruising. And you can contrast that to like these Cavaliers where like Derek Williams is out there running around and, you know, Kyrie's doing his one-on-five thing in some of these games. And like, if LeBron's not on the court handling everything, it looks like a complete mess. They're giving all these minutes to random guys. They're seriously considering somebody like Andrew Bogut. I don't know. It just doesn't really feel like Cleveland's this unassailable defending champion who's going to really like have this strong start, you know, this strong defense of their title. It kind of feels more like they're, you know, on pretty shaky ground, honestly, especially compared to Golden State.
Yeah, they're definitely more beatable this year than they have been. Can we talk about the buyout sweepstakes? Because, like,
yeah, of course.
You bring up the Cavs, and I've seen a lot of people like champion their deadline and call them like the secret winners for stealing Deron Williams, and then maybe, I mean, who knows where Andrew Bogut is going to go. But then they have Kyle Korver and Derek Williams. My issue is that these guys aren't necessarily good anymore. Like, whoever gets Andrew Bogut if Bogut's healthy, like, he's helpful. But I'm having trouble talking myself into any of these guys being a factor down the stretch. Like, maybe Deron Williams plays like 10 useful minutes in the finals. I just don't really get it. And I think it might be that we're just all bored and have to like get excited about some of these moves, but I don't know, man. I mean, like, Cleveland, Deron Williams, this goes back to LeBron. Like, I don't know how you get so obsessed about a playmaker, because none of this shit is going to matter against Golden State.
Yeah. I think Deron Williams helps in the shorter term just because, you know, they've got so many guys who've been in and out of the lineup, and LeBron is doing so much that he gives you a stability factor, you know, short term between now and the playoffs. But if we're looking solely through the lens of, is this guy going to be a real difference maker against Golden State? I think the answer is probably not. And especially in the case of Bogut, I mean, can Bogut even stay on the court when Golden State goes to their smaller lineup? I mean, who is he going to guard? Draymond? I mean, KD? Yeah. Like, what? Is he going to chase David West around? I mean, who's the guy that you feel comfortable leaving him on the court? Like, if Mozgov can't stay on the court last year, how is Bogut going to stay on the court this year when he's another year deeper into his injuries, another year past 30? You know, I'm not sure.
Bogut, the Pizzagate truther. Yeah, man, I don't know. Like, I think his absence did make a difference in last year's finals, but put him on Cleveland, and there aren't many minutes that he would play for the Cavs that where they would not be better with Tristan Thompson just playing 40 minutes.
Well, that's kind of what I'm saying, because he can stay on the court because you have a guy like Tristan Thompson who's not going to be spreading you out and doing crazy stuff. Everything Tristan does is off the offensive glass within like 5 feet of the hoop, right? So yeah. You also need Bogut to protect against the Kyrie, you know, flurries to the hoop and LeBron taking it hard to the rim. So that skill set's very helpful. Like, does it work the other way where, you know, Kevin Durant, how often is he really going one-on-one all the way to the rim to collapse the defense? You know, everything they're doing is on the outside spread out. Really, like, just who does he guard? Like, who's his man on Golden State? I mean, they pretty much always have, you know, some version of, like, five out, you know, with at least out to the free throw line.
There's a version of the finals where, like, Andrew Bogut is guarding Kevin Durant one-on-one down the stretch, and it just, like, it really underscores how unfair the offseason was for the Warriors. And the Cavs are just stuck depending on this like broken down, bought out version of Andrew Bogut while Durant just does whatever he wants on offense.
Yeah, that got really depressing.
It's like, shout out to the NBA for ruining the CBA and allowing this to happen.
Hey, actually, I saw some people complaining, though. You mentioned like Cleveland's like the quiet winners, and I think there's some winning to be had just because nobody else got up to their level.
Yeah.
You know, Toronto had a nice deadline, I thought.
Toronto
but,
did a
you
great
know, Boston
job.
Kind of sitting it out definitely makes Cleveland, you know, sit pretty. But do you think this buyout system is fair? I saw some grumbling on Twitter about just how easy it was for Cleveland to add rotation players. They don't have to give up future second round picks. I mean, do you kind of get what people are saying with that in terms of, you know, like if you're Toronto, you have to pay 2 second round picks to get PJ Tucker. If you're Cleveland, you just snap your fingers and Deron Williams shows up. Like, is that fair?
Yeah, I do like it because I think the NBA is best when it's top heavy, and it's more fun to see a guy like Deron Williams play like relevant playoff games late in May than adding him to, I don't know, like who's the seventh seed right now, like adding him to the Pacers or somebody, you know what I mean? Like, I'd rather concentrate some of the veteran talent on the teams that are going to be going deep into the playoffs.
I feel you. So you're basically anti-competitive balance and you hate the small market teams.
Yo, I kind of am anti-competitive balance unless there's like a TV loophole that allows the best team in the NBA to sign the best player in the NBA. So that took it a little bit too far. But in general, I think the league is in a healthy spot. Yeah, I don't know. What else should we cover? Should we talk about JaVale and Shaq?
Yeah, that's an entire situation in need of some serious reality checks, right?
Sure. I mean, look.
I'm just trying to really pound this theme home, but like we've got two grown men screaming on social media about how they're basically going to beat each other up. We've got JaVale essentially going to the authorities with Golden State's help to kind of cry foul on Shaq's conduct. We have their mothers entering the fray here with their thoughts about, you know, whether it's gone too far or not. I mean, this is just something that should not happen or should not exist.
So do you have a side here? Because I'm not a big Shaq guy. I think Shaq would be a lot more enjoyable if he just weren't on TV. But like in the TNT role, he's kind of always trying a little bit too hard to be funny, can't really take a joke himself, and every time he's like making a point or breaking things down, I'm kind of like, I would rather be hearing from Ernie, Kenny, or Chuck on this one. So that said, like, JaVale McGee is just a doofus, and I've never liked him, and it's hard for me to sort of treat him like a victim here, because look, Shaq's not calling out play, like all this material is out there. Like JaVale McGee, he's done this for 6 or 7 years and it's just like all on tape.
Okay, so Steve Kerr said that he had a misconception about JaVale McGee before he arrived in Golden State because of the Shaq and a fool. And your counter to argument is that
that's
JaVale
not a
McGee
misconception.
Is just a doofus. Okay.
Yeah. Like my counter is that nope, you had an accurate idea of who JaVale McGee is as a basketball player, and that's fine.
So basically, your counter to Steve Kerr is like he's a doofus, but he's your doofus, so you have to stand up for him, basically.
Yeah, I totally understand them standing up for him. The only thing I didn't like was Durant saying, didn't he say that Shaq was just bigger than everybody and had no skill?
Yeah, he did really kind of go after Shaq's game, trying to discount him, talking about the free throws. And he also said that he didn't know that, you know, law enforcement officials could talk to civilians like that on Twitter.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good line. Whoever wrote that one for Durant, that's pretty good.
Yeah, no, that was solid. I mean, that's obviously ridiculous, though, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, Shaq's one of the greats, and they're just trying to jab back. It's sort of like Draymond jabbing back and trying to discount Paul Pierce's legacy. I mean, these guys are really in, like, hold the fort down, like, we're just going to fire back at everyone who comes at us mode. And you kind of want that. You know, this team's problem has been complacency and thinking that they're too good. And one way to prevent against that is to just constantly be in wars with everybody.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of getting sick of this, like, this bickering, like the nonstop undertone of bickering with inside the NBA. Like, everybody could just relax. And the JaVale stuff, I wouldn't call him a doofus if he weren't a doofus. Like, he just, even when he was in DC, he didn't really treat people that well, and he doesn't really have like a sense of humor about any of this. And have never been a fan. I like compare JaVale to someone like Nick Young, who's sort of like takes everything in stride and is able to laugh his way through everything and has sort of leaned into it. And I think people like Nick Young because of that. Whereas JaVale, this is just like a bad look for everyone. And that's actually a good, like, every time these players bicker back and forth with the inside the NBA guys, like, it's kind of everyone ends up looking bad. So maybe the league can step in and just be like, everyone needs a chill. And TNT can dial it back a little bit, and then players can stop calling these guys out, because it's not a great look for anybody involved.
Well, JaVale does have a plus 17.5 net rating this year when he's on the court with those starters. They're awesome. I mean, his offensive rating is 118.9, which is like legendarily high. So I kind of get their point in that just only showing the doofus stuff is not the full story of JaVale this year. I mean, JaVale has resurrected a career that was not even on life support. It was just dead. I mean, he's brought it all the way back. He's playing really important minutes for an awesome team. And, you know, he's not flawless, but he serves that, you know, lob finishing role. And, you know, he's not the greatest defensive player in the world, but he's out there giving them minutes and, you know, certainly probably contributing more than a lot of people expected back during training camp. And so, can you understand their frustration a little bit about the way he's still being kind of portrayed as this idiot when he's trying to get his life and his career back on track? And it's not a guy who's making that much money either, you know? Like, he's kind of a big target for somebody to kind of go after him.
Yeah, look.
And Shaq clearly enjoys doing that.
I totally understand their frustration, and it's totally fair, but it's like he has this reputation for a reason.
I got to say, though, I am a little proud of you here, because you're not letting JaVale off the hook. You're holding him accountable for his past behavior. And Andrew, you know, you turn 30. You enter a wiser stage of your career. You realize it's not just about the moment. It's about an entire track record of behavior. And for that, you know, I just want to welcome you to the Washed Club. I mean, it feels totally good to have you as a member.
I turned 30 and I turned into Ben Golliver. That's pretty
it's
terrifying.
Perfect. It's great.
But all right, a couple more here. I have two. I mean, should we even talk about the Cuban thing with Bleacher Report? Because that was insane, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's another one. Reality check. We've really got a clear theme here. What was he doing? Why?
Yeah, it's like, obviously, there were people who were like, this is like Donald Trump-type censorship. And that's true to an extent. But it's also just like, if I had $1 billion, I would not be on Twitter, like, seeking out disrespect for my star player. Like, that wasn't even really, like, a thing. It wasn't even that disrespectful. It's a weirder look from him to get pissed off about some dumbass, like, Bleacher Report tweet than it is to try and censor, like, the coverage of his athletes.
Yeah, so anyone who didn't see it, I mean, Cuban goes and sends an email to the head of Turner basically saying, hey, take this tweet down. The tweet had an air ball shot by Dirk Nowitzki. And, you know, he just didn't want, you know, Dirk kind of mocked on social media.
He
it
also,
wasn't like it went insanely viral. It wasn't like the story
Adam
of
Silver?
The day. He did, yeah. You know, he went straight to the top.
It's like, chill out, Mark Cuban.
Well, it kind of goes back to, remember the NBA sent out that memo saying, like, no snarky tweets back and forth after the whole Blazers versus Chandler Parsons drama? It seems like this is sort of this point of contention about, like, what is good marketing, you know, what's damaging. I'm not sure I see any way in which bloopers are that damaging to the league. And that maybe even goes back to the JaVale McGee Shaq and a Fool thing. Like, I could understand why a player would take it personally if he was routinely mocked on national TV, but just random bloopers and whether the guy's a Hall of Famer or not a Hall of Famer, like, how does that hurt the league's image? You know, isn't that part of the game? We've had blooper tapes since what, you know, 70s, 80s?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't really get it. And it was just sort of like, I guess every couple months, Mark Cuban feels the need to remind everyone that he's like kind of crazy. And I used to love Cuban, but he just does, again, like every couple months, he does something a little bit indefensible. And that's just sort of par for the course. It's so different than the way Dirk would have actually probably laughed that off and handled it perfectly. And I don't know, the difference between him and Dirk is tough to handle. If I were a Mavs fan, I would just be praying for him to just stop like talking in public.
No, you're totally right about Dirk, because one of the very first All-Star games I went to, this might have been like 2011 or 12. I was like, I didn't have a work area, so I was at the stadium, like sitting on the ground, rapidly scrolling through Getty Images pictures, and I happened to be searching for a picture of Dirk, like a funny picture, just to go with my story or whatever. Dirk walked by, looked at my screen, saw pictures of himself, pointed at my screen and said, "Hey, that's me, man," huh? And then just kept walking. So, like, yeah, he has he has the exact personality that would not care at all. And there was actually a situation too where somebody was, I think it might have been Kevin Pelton, was talking about his defense not too long ago in terms of being like cement footed or just slow at this stage of his career. And he retweeted it and was like, "Yeah, that's completely right. That's who I am." You know, he gets it. He's not in denial about his age related decline. And Dirk isn't the same guy, you know, and I think that's kind of part of the tweet that they were writing, which is like Dirk forever. It's like, this is kind of wrapping up. You know, people were mocking Kobe's shot selection and shooting percentage for most of last year. I did an entire article comparing him to this guy from the 1950s who shot like 30% and took like 40 shots a game. You know, when you're making that much money, you're the face of the franchise. Like, you're set up for that. I don't understand. Is Cuban serious about just being the Twitter police? Is he going to do this every single time? I don't get it. Yeah. I really don't get where he's coming from.
So
I think it sets a bad precedent that they took it down. And, you know, Adam Silver is going to have to provide some more clarity on this issue. I mean, clearly they're talking about it with that memo, like I said. But there shouldn't ever be a situation where something like that goes public and plays out like that. I think Cuban makes the NBA look bad,
dude,
as opposed to the
Cuban
Twitter.
Cuban released those emails himself. Like, how tone deaf do you have to be to think that this was going to be some sort of like own on Bleacher Report?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess he was trying to rally the Mavs fan base or just trying to make the guy look bad. I don't know.
But, you know, I think the lesson here is that we would all, like, Dirk Nowitzki is probably like top three in terms of NBA players I'd want to hang out with.
Oh, for sure. And watch bloopers with. I would love to hear Dirk like narrate an hour of his own blooper clips. Bring that on. Like, that sounds like great viral content.
Talking through this has just made me realize how much I love Dirk. I guess the place that we should end is the Sacramento Kings. Have you softened at all on the trade and how it happened?
No. Why would I?
I'm kind of softening a little bit. I don't know.
No, don't do it. Are you talking yourself into Buddy Hield, or are you just pretending that they're better without DeMar? I mean, what's your argument?
Well, my argument is, I mean, I came down on them pretty hard in an article last week, and the more I look at it, the more it makes sense that the market for Cousins wasn't very good. I do think that like it's kind of inexcusable that they didn't like face reality a year and a half ago, and that's where you should criticize the Kings. But now, like, they are going to be a lot more fun without the boogie cloud hanging over everything. Like, I'm actually pretty excited to root for Willie Cauley-Stein and Buddy Hield.
Okay. Don't they bear some responsibility, though, for the soft market, the way they handled him?
Oh. I mean,
they couldn't have handled it worse.
A million percent they bear responsibility for that. So, like, I guess okay. I'm not really, like, softening on the return they got, but I do think that you have to look at this. Because I think even if they held out and said, "We're not giving you Boogie unless you give us two first-round picks," like, the Pelicans would have done that. Even if they waited until Thursday, the Pelicans would have made that move. But having said that, what I'm saying is that I'm kind of on the Kings bandwagon right now.
Yeah, and we had talked about that way before it even happened, that like they could become a more fun team. And, you know, the first game out of the break, that like everything came together, Cauley-Stein was going nuts. It seemed like this really amazing turnaround story. But I was watching their game against Minnesota last night, and they get down 10, 12 points in the second half, and you start looking around at their roster and saying, who's even capable of leading a comeback here? Like, who could actually do this?
Yeah.
And the answer is nobody, you know? And so from that standpoint, not having Cousins you know, sheer talent, not having his force of personality, that leaves big holes. And I think they're now in a situation where they're wondering how many more lottery trips are they going to have to suffer through until they can make a real playoff push. I mean, how far away is this team?
You know? Yeah. I mean, they're definitely a year or two, three, four away. I don't know. Look, it's the dead zone, man. Thank you to everyone who hung out with us here. I don't really have like a crazy amount of takes, so I don't. Should we just roll this over until Friday for the mailbag?
We've been getting some awesome mailbag questions, some really funny mailbag questions, so keep sending those in for sure. Check us out on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe. Give us that 5-star review. Don't forget, check out Rob Mahoney's Breakaway podcast. It's awesome. Learn all about Houston Rockets and their system. You won't regret it. I can tell you that. You'll learn a lot. Andrew, until that mailbag podcast, I will talk to you later.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.